You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it's been an interesting morning, or day, I guess. It may be morning where you are. It's 3 in the afternoon where I am. Mike Rogers, the Republican head of the Permanent Select Committee on House Intelligence. What's the actual? There's a whole title to his committee, and it is a variation on that. Chairman Mike Rogers. Okay, well, it doesn't say in the news story. And, oh, here it is. It's the House Intelligence Committee. He titled this. This should give you a clue. Okay. Now, first of all, let me just set this up. You've got an employee of a private contractor. The contractor is Booz Allen Hamilton, which gets 98 or 99% of all their money from federal contracts. And you've got an employee of this private, for-profit, corporate contractor whose CEO makes like over $3 million a year. And, you know, it's a for-profit company with our tax dollars. And he used to work inside the government, and now he works at a contractor outside, and he's been back and forth and back and forth. So anyhow, you've got an employee of this contractor who goes over to Hong Kong and says, you really need to know what these contractors know, because these contractors who are handling this information, it's been outsourced to them, 70% more or less. These contractors are handling data, and they can, you know, if they choose, I was one of them, he says, if they choose, they can look deep down inside the data and get things like content. Then the contractors hand off the metadata. Okay, so just follow this for a second. The contractors have everything. Out of the everything, they extract just the telephone numbers, the time, the place, the calls, what's called the metadata. And they ship that off to the NSA. So the NSA doesn't actually have your phone call or your email running through their computers. The contractors do. And this is why the New York Times, in an op-ed today, is calling for us to bring this contract work in-house. It's why I've been doing that for 2 weeks now, both in op-eds and on this program. Because, as Ed Snowden pointed out, the contractors actually can look deep down inside your stuff. And as Lee Fong pointed out, in the past, I mean, so, you know, one of these contractors was actually conspiring to try to bring down Glenn Greenwald, the reporter and lawyer who broke this story, because they saw him as a potential threat. And the contractors could kind of do that on the side because, hey, it's a for-profit corporation. They can do it in more than one thing. So the contractors can snoop on you. The NSA only gets the data from the contractors, the metadata. They can't snoop on you. This is basically what Snowden has been saying all along. So there's a PR problem here. And Mike Rogers, the Republican from Michigan, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, says, let's hold a hearing. Let's find out what's really going on. He titles the hearing. And this is where I interrupted myself about 3 minutes ago. And I said, this should have been the dead giveaway. He titles the hearing, quote, this is the official title of the hearing that was held today. How disclosed NSA programs protect Americans and why disclosure aids our adversaries. Yeah, that's the title. And you would think with the New York Times editorializing about this and people all over America talking about it from right to left, with people like me and people like Glenn Beck agreeing on this issue of these private contractors, like actually I shouldn't speak for Glenn Beck. I have not spoken with him. I don't know exactly what he's saying, but from what I read. In any case, right across the board, we had Jamie Weinstein on a couple days ago from the Daily Caller. I don't want to characterize what anybody said except me. And that is that I think that these private contractors, A, they have loyalty to the profit motive and not necessarily to us. And in fact, in some cases, some of their stockholders, some of their ownership is not even in the United States. Booz Allen Hamilton is largely owned by the Carlyle Group, which has foreign investors, including Saudi sheikhs, who own the company that owns your phone calls. Okay, so anyhow, knowing all this, you would assume that the first question that Mike Rogers asks General Alexander, who is the head of the NSA, would be, can the contractors, because Ed Snowden was a contractor, or worked for a contractor, can the contractors look at our, can they listen to our phone calls? You'd think that would be that should be the most important question of the day, right? Because, I mean, we all know the NSA can't unless they go through a FISA court and then they got to jump through some hoops and basically hand it off to the FBI. The question is, can the contractors do this? So here's the questioning made for television to reassure all of us between Mike Rogers, the chairman of the committee, and General Alexander, the head of the NSA, at this hearing titled How Disclosed NSA Programs Protect Americans. Here is the question.
Is the NSA have the ability to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails under these two programs?
No, we do not have that authority.
Does the technology exist at the NSA to flip a switch by some analyst to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails?
No.
So the technology does not exist for any individual or group of individuals at the NSA to flip a switch to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails?
That is correct.
At the NSA. Did you notice he didn't ask about the contractors? Could it be that the reason Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, didn't ask about the contractors is because if you are the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and you decide to resign from Congress or you lose the next election, you are virtually guaranteed a multi-million dollar a year job with one of those contractors? I'm not making this stuff up. People leave Congress and they go to work for the industry of their choice. Chris Dodd is working for the banking industry now. We all thought he was a good guy. I mean, he's a Democrat. He was a good guy. Right? Dodd-Frank? But when somebody dangles $1 million a year paycheck in front of you, or $2 million or $3 million or $5 million a year paycheck in front of you, and members of Congress start out at $500,000 to $1 million a year with the lobbyists in town and the big industries in town. And if they're committee chairman, like Mike Rogers, he could start out at $3 million or $5 million a year. And this is business as usual in Washington, D.C. And General Alexander probably has a cushy landing spot should he decide to stop being a four-star general and the head of the NSA. Oh, you want to be on the board of Lockheed or Boeing or Carlyle Group? Sure, have a few million bucks. Have a private jet. We take care of our own. This hearing today, in my mind, and the Democrats who asked questions were rather timid, but I mean, this is a very, very intimidating environment right now. This system is so badly broken because our Supreme Court has said that corporations can legally buy politicians and own politicians. That our Supreme Court has said that money is the same thing as speech and that corporations are the same thing as persons. It has so corrupted our system that we're seeing this kind of theater.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which is why you need to get over to movetoamend.org and sign up and join up and participate, because we can do something about this. Okay, a couple of things I wanted to share with you. First, for those of you listening here in Washington, D.C. on We Act Radio or any of the other various ways people acquire this program, this coming Saturday, June 22nd at 2:30 at the Portrait Gallery, here in Washington, D.C. That's right down at the corner of Yeah, let's see. That would be, I used to live a block from there. So that would be at E or F and 8th. 8th kind of dead ends into it. Anyhow, the Portrait Gallery in the Northwest, in Penn Quarter, right by the Galleria exit from the Red Line. At 2:30 on Saturday, that we're going to be showing a movie. I will be there doing a Q&A or moderating a question and answer after the film with the Oscar-winning filmmaker, Barbara Koppel. And it's a film about the Hemingways. It's called Running from Crazy, and it's much of it is the story of Mariel Hemingway, the granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway. But it kind of starts with Ernest and ends with her, and I think you're going to find it fascinating. And, you know, how this family has been plagued with mental illness, substance abuse, and suicide, which seems to carry from one generation to the next. It should be, fascinating. So that's this Saturday. Also, back from my Portland days, when I was living in Portland and we were doing the morning show there and everything, I used to fly out of the Portland airport a lot, and there was a guy named Jim Riva, R-I-V-A, who I first met. He was working at the bar in the Red Carpet Club, they called it, the United Airlines Frequent Flyer Club, in the airport in Portland. And I'm not sure if he's still working at the airport or not. I haven't talked with Jim in a year or two, but he wrote a book. And I'm sitting at the bar, and he's like, so what do you do? And I said, well, you know, I'm an author. And he's like, oh, me too. And I'm like, cool, you know, let me see your book. And so he gives it to me. And I read it on the plane, and it was one of the best books I'd ever read. I mean, it was just it's a fiction. It's a work of fiction, and it's called The Geographer. And it's hysterically funny, incredibly fascinating, a brilliant insight into other cultures. And Jim just sent me a note that I wanted to share with you, saying just a note to say that my ebook, The Geographer, will be free for 5 days starting today. That was yesterday. Through Amazon's KDP Select program. So if you go over to jimriva.com, R-I-V-A, jimriva.com, you can download a free copy. So this is just a personal recommendation. I loved the book, and Jim has written a couple of other books, too, that are really, you know, worth reading. And we used to get together periodically when I was in Portland. I haven't seen him since we left, and would love to get together with him again. Louise and I have had dinner over at his home. It's one of those things, you know, you meet somebody and just, hey, this is, you know. In any case, oh, also in Portland, KBOO, for those of you who are watching us in Portland, Oregon on Free Speech TV, or who are listening on radio or whatever it may be, KBOO Community Radio has as the question at the top of their homepage, take our survey, Tom Hartman on KBOO Community Radio. A lot of Pacifica stations, we've been on Pacifica for 2.5 years, I think, and recently many of the larger stations have started picking us up down in Los Angeles and San Diego now. Portland is looking at it. So if you go to KBOO, KBOO.FM, if you live in Portland, and if you're familiar with KBOO Community Radio, you can let them know your thoughts on that. It's the question at the top of the page. So, all that said, the circus of the day was in the House of Representatives. But here's the other thing that I found amazing. And this is a story that came out yesterday, but it's like the fact that, as far as I can tell, nobody's talking about it today. We really all should be talking about it. And that is, you know, Rand Paul, the Libertarians. In fact, Beyond Rand Paul, let me back up a little bit here. About 3 days ago on Alternet, 3 or 4 days ago, it's June 17th, it must have been yesterday or the day before, Alternet published this piece, today's 18th, so it was yesterday, 9 Ways the Right's Ayn Randian Experiment Screws Over the Young. It was by Richard Eskow, R.J. Eskow. And he ends it, now I would have opened this article with, I think he buried the lead. This is how I would have opened the article. But it's the last couple of paragraphs. Dear millennials, we tried to stop them. We failed. We're sorry. You, the millennials, will continue to carry the dubious distinction of being the first generation of Americans to have been assaulted from the cradle to the grave. And the reason why is because the millennials, people born in the 1980s, were the very earliest, youngest of the millennial generation. And, you know, up until, including now, I guess. So, and he, what he does is he documents, you know, the whole Ayn Rand thing. Ayn Rand, who, he says, Rand reviled the less fortunate, even those who, and even those who tried to help them as parasites, while at the same time idolizing sociopathic killers. And then he says, that last statement isn't rhetoric, it's reporting. And then he quotes from Ayn Rand. He has the true innate psychology of a Superman, Rand wrote admiringly of child murderer and dismemberer William Edward Hickman. He can never realize and feel other people. Mark Ames points out that this echoes Rand's description of her hero in The Fountainhead. He was born without the ability to consider others. So anyhow, the Ayn Rand ideology has infected our country ever since Reagan. And now literally programs from cradle to grave, from early infant, from infant programs, early education, early nutrition, all the way to Social Security, have been being cut consistently ever since Reagan because of Ayn Rand's ideology. And now Rand Paul comes forward and he says, oh, this immigration bill, let's not have a path to citizenship in it. Let's instead just open up lots and lots and lots of worker visas. In other words, let all the people who want to come into this country, let them in. Give them visas if an employer will hire them. And then the employer has the power to pull their visa and get them thrown out of the country. So they're basically slaves. They're vassals. I mean, their lives, their livelihood, their ability to stay in the country depends on the goodwill of their employer. You think they're going to ask for a raise or complain about working conditions? Rand Paul, a true Ayn Rand follower.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, after all, his daddy Ron Paul named his son after the sociopath Ayn Rand, and he's following in her footsteps. Incredible. Okay, so a bunch of people in North Carolina showed up and said, you know, we don't think that blocking the expansion of Medicare is a good idea. We don't like the discriminatory voter ID laws that make it harder for poor people or older people or students or unemployed people to vote. We don't like the fact that you want to cut preschool for 30,000 kids. These are proposals which have already, many of them have already passed the state legislature. The Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, has this list, allowing for hydraulic fracking, repealing the Racial Justice Act, and more. 84 of these protesters were arrested. Yeah. These were faith leaders. These were people, you know, church folks, coming out and saying, hey, you know, we're called to be with each other, you know, to be America is a community. We should stand in solidarity. Margaret Thatcher said there's no such thing as society. There's no such thing as community. There are people. Actually, I can give you her exact quote. Who is society? There is no such thing. There are individual men and women, and there are families. Margaret Thatcher. And this is the beginning of the Ayn Rand, Rand Paulization of America. So. And it's extending now to the NSA. So what do you think? James in Bonita Springs, Florida, listening on WCPT's stream at WCPT.com. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'm calling because this whole thing about contractors foreshadowing the privatization of the NSA and other intelligence agencies is just wrong, because that's not what's happening. Ed Snowden and other contractors like him are nothing more than temporary employees hired by the NSA to do specific tasks, and the work product that they produce ends up belonging to the NSA, not the temp agencies like Booz Allen Hamilton that provided this workforce to fill to provide resources to the NSA and other agencies.
How do you know that?
I know that because I have a very, very close friend of mine who has a very high security clearance, higher than Ed Snowden's, who has filled these contract positions for decades, and he lives out there by you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a lot of very, very, it's mind-boggling. You go, you know, 10 miles outside this town, and there's like, you know, 40-room mansions that just ring this town, that the wealthiest zip code in the entire country is here, and it's mostly defense contractors. And but that said, I think that we're splitting hairs here. You're saying they're temporary employees. You know, Ed Snowden had an employment contract with Booz Allen. Booz Allen had a contract with the NSA. You can call that whatever you want. I call that privatizing or outsourcing. And I think that, you know, if we as a nation are going to authorize our government to be looking into our private lives, and we're going to do so, and we're going to authorize actual individuals to be handling our and listening to and looking at our phone calls and our Skype videos and our emails and everything else, those people should be federal employees who are subject to the Freedom of Information Act, who are subject to civil service regulations and rules, who are subject to oversight by Congress.
Employees are subject to those same rules and those same.
They are not. They are not. There's a very specific. I'm sorry. If your friend is telling you this, he's wrong, and I'll assume he's just, you know, wrong for the best of reasons. But there is a very specific carve out in the Whistleblower Act that says that employees of national security agencies are not subject to the Whistleblower Act. So Ed Snowden, if he worked for the NSA, would have had a system within the federal government where he could go and he could say, "I'm blowing the whistle on this. This is wrong." At a private contractor, he may or may not have that depending on the policies of that contractor. And the contractor may or may not decide to put that into place. It's entirely up to them. There is no protection for their employees at law.
I would urge you to read the last three blog posts on my website.
Well, I would urge you to read the New York Times about this. You know, there's an op-ed in today's article. James, if you want to plug your website, go for it.
It's disposableamericans.net. Just click on Jim's blog.
Okay, got it. James, thanks a lot for the call. Joe in Ashburnham, Massachusetts. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi there. I got the solution.
Okay.
Privatize Gitmo.
Okay.
Why? Then they can't investigate. They can't complain. They can't sue. They can't do anything.
So how does this help the people in Gitmo or us as a nation?
Well, no, Obama privatizes it, and then he sends his people in to close it down.
Oh. Oh, well, the way to do it then would be to privatize it and then get a bunch of wealthy donors to buy the stock of the corporation and then shut down the corporation. But see, my fear would be that once it's privatized, it would become a profit center, and then it would pretty soon it would go from a population of, you know, 170 or whatever it is down there now to, you know, 170,000. It's like, you know, the private prisons. But I get it. I realize it was half tongue in cheek. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Deidre in Congress, Arizona. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I've called before.
Okay.
Deidre is proper.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to. About the NSA, I know after 9/11 for a fact that 200 new agencies, intelligence gathering agencies, were built around Washington, Virginia, Maryland, and across the United States right after 9/11. And then 1,700 more were built across around the world to gather any intelligence on anybody that they want. So, and Clapper up there, when they said he lied to Congress, when he said not wittingly that they knew, you know, about what certain things were listening on phone calls, not
right.
wittingly,
right.
he couldn't say anything different before a public hearing.
Yeah, I'm sure. And that's why later he said, you know, I said the least dishonest thing I could say. I thought it was interesting the order of the questions and the phrase of the questions today. Listen to the first question. This is Mike Rogers asking General Alexander, and he doesn't say, do you have the ability? Now, in the second question, he says, do you actually have the ability? Can you flip a switch? But I thought the first one was very interestingly phrased. Here it is.
Is the NSA have the ability to listen to
ability.
Americans' phone calls or read their emails under these two programs?
No, we do not have that authority.
Authority. So it goes from ability to authority. But then he says, you know, can you flip a switch and can anybody there listen in? And the general says no. I think that, you know, that actually concerns me. I mean, you got a spy agency that can't spy on people. I think that they should be able to spy on people. And I want them to be able to spy on bad guys that the court, you know, somebody has gone in before a court and said, yeah, this is definitely a bad guy. Although maybe, you know, their job is instead, if it's inside the United States, just to hand it off to the FBI. But, Deirdre, thank you very much for the call. Mark in Plainfield, Illinois. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. What's up?
First time calling you, so I'm a little nervous on this one. But last week on the Jay Leno show, they were talking about the ability to turn on a switch and listen to anybody's conversation like you just were talking with the other listener. And Shia LaBeouf, going back to his movie he was plugging for when the supercomputer was running the world with all the cameras, he had an FBI agent as a trainer to guide him through the movie and help him with his character role. He had said, and it was Thursday on the monologue, which Jay brought this part that Shia was talking about, and he brought back that segment, and he had Shia on TV said his FBI trainer had brought to him a question, do you think that we can listen to anybody's conversations? And Shia goes, I don't think you have that type of technology. He said, quote, the guy had gone to a phone, came back, gave him a conversation that he had a week ago with a friend on the phone, said it to him word for word, and he could not believe it. And Jay Leno plugged that segment last Thursday, and Shia LaBeouf sitting there goes, so if they don't have the technology you're saying right now, and I was just watching the Senate and the FBI, the head and the NSA.
It's the head of the NSA, not the head of the FBI. See, I think my guess is if there is a carefully parsed truth in here, and there probably almost certainly is, it's that the NSA doesn't actually do the deep packet inspection. They don't do the, you know, let's get all the detail. They get the metadata. They get that handed to them from the contractors. So the contractors, like Ed Snowden, have the ability to look deep inside and actually see the content. They hand off the metadata to the NSA. If from an analysis of the metadata, in other words, who called whom and when and for how long they talked, all that kind of thing, they see that, you know, somebody in Chicago is calling, you know, somebody in Pakistan who has been calling somebody in Saudi Arabia who was involved in a bombing that was in Somalia or something like that, then they hand that off to the FBI, and the FBI taps that person's phone or pulls out those records or goes to whoever that guy's phone company is, you know, Verizon or AT&T or whoever, and says, okay, you know, you've been keeping all this information, all the phone calls, all the everything for the last X number of months. The different companies have different standards, 18 months, 24 months, 36 months. Give us this from 2 weeks ago, Thursday at 3 o'clock. And so it makes sense to me that the FBI would be able to do that. But, you know, for an FBI agent to do that just to impress a movie star, that's the kind of thing where you're saying, you know, there could be abuse within the system. And thanks, Mark, for the call. And again, that FBI agent, I doubt he was working for the FBI as a trainer for a movie star. He was probably working as a private contractor. Although he was using it. I mean, I'm guessing the guy is probably in deep trouble right now for having, you know, violated that law.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
For either having violated that fellow's confidentiality without a court order or for having disclosed that he had the ability to do so, one or the other. That's fascinating. 10 minutes before the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joe in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Joe.
Hey, what's up, Tom?
You heard General Alexander today. What'd you think?
To be quite honest, it was a load of BS. It really is splitting hairs, like you were saying to the previous caller. But before I go on my rant here, I just wanted to say about the whole comment on society thing and there's no such thing as community. It's really disheartening to hear people talk like that, especially here in the United States. We do have a very tight community. It's just sad that we got people in Congress that are like that. And and it kind of segues into this because there is a lack of community, and you can see that by what's going on in Congress when it comes to this. if that was your family member and you were hearing somebody talk about whatever to them like that, would you be concerned? It's like they've totally divided themselves off from the rest of the public.
Talk to a family member about what, like what?
Oh, what I'm saying is, because we have this disconnect between community, family, and our government, you got a lot. That's why there's a lot of this, in my opinion, a lot of this. Oh well, it's okay to spy on your neighbor. You know, kind of make it a German Stasi state or something like that. It's just kind of just disheartening.
Yeah.
But if you go to the Atlantic.com, they have a really good article about three former employees corroborating the key claims of Edward Snowden.
These three former whistleblowers.
Switch if they wanted to. I think the real key part is what you've been hitting home on, and that's the accountability of these contractors.
Yeah.
And with family members overseas in the military, I've heard them complain so many times that these contractors get away with things, can do stuff that they don't want, that they don't have to do or don't want to do.
Yep.
There's just no accountability for them. And I think it's a real tragic mistake that people are trying to bury Edward Snowden under all this stuff about his girlfriend's hot and all this other stuff, when really the issue is government accountability and corporate accountability.
There you go. I'm with you, Joe. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. I think in my opinion, this is mine, you may agree or disagree, I think the biggest point in this whole NSA scandal, so to speak, is what they're doing, and they've had the ability to do it for probably 15, 20 years, but what I think they're trying to do is politically seeing how the people tolerate these hearings and tolerate the loss of privacy. Mm. They're determining what they have to do to legitimize the usage of cell phone tracking for over 15, 20 years.
Will we all just go back to sleep?
Well, what they can do is they can track any of us 7/24 with our cell phones.
Sure. Sure. So you're suggesting that the purpose of these hearings is to see if we'll just all go back to talking about the Kardashians or whatever instead of talking about the NSA.
Well, it's that, but it's pretty much all politically motivated so that they can set the groundwork if they need it to legitimize the unconstitutionality of our loss of freedom and privacy unbeknownst to us for the last 15 years or 20 years. They've had this up. Early 90s, they were playing with it.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover was doing this kind of stuff. I mean, that's what led to the church hearings, in part. I mean, it wasn't entirely that. But the church hearings did not come about because of Watergate. They came about because of a whistleblower. And then they wandered into the area of Watergate. But, Hoover was doing this. We have this history, Armin, in this country of overreaching and then pulling ourselves back from the abyss. And I think that we're at one of those moments right now where we could be pulling ourselves back from the abyss, and we should be doing it. We should be doing it aggressively. And I'm very, after watching this hearing this morning, I'm very concerned that we are not. But, time will tell. Armin, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Bill, in Knoxville, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about the Ayn Rand Republicans and Christians.
Yes, Tom. First of all, I just want you to know it is so refreshing to hear a talk radio, to hear a wise voice on the radio instead of someone who's all the time only pushing their ideals.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the compliment.
I follow everything that you say. I am about 99% exact in line with what you talk about, except that I am a Christian.
Mm-hmm. I call myself a Christian.
Well, okay. Well, then I do respect.
I do. I don't. I'm not an evangelical. I would never say to anybody else that they should become a Christian, but I call myself a Christian. So, an evangelical Christian would say I'm not a Christian in any case, go ahead, Bill.
Well, the part of Christianity that I do love and that I do follow is that, they have compassion for the poor and the weakest among us.
Yes, I mean, I think that Matthew 25 is the essence of Christianity, and Sermon on the Mount.
Well, anyway, I see these people who are in our Congress who claim to be Christians and still follow the Ayn Rand books,
mm-hmm.
which to me are the most anti-Christian books that there ever were.
I agree, and Ayn Rand would agree.
They can live with themselves.
Yeah, Ayn Rand has spoken about this. She had a famous interview with Mike Wallace back in the 60s. In fact, we've got a clip of it floating around here someplace where he says, you know, you say that, you know, you're opposed to Christianity and that people who, you know, whatever, are weak and don't deserve to live and whatnot. And she says, yeah, you know, it's just it's amazing. And you got the clip? Hey, here it is. Listen to this.
What's wrong with loving your fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself.
There you go. Ayn Rand herself, in her own words. So, Bill, what do you think?
I'm just praying that, you know, the people who vote for these, to me, these nutbags who claim to be one thing and then turn around and do something else. I just hope that people can see through, the fact that they are not compassionate Christian people.
I'm with you. Bill, thank you very much for the call. And this, I mean, you know, Rand Paul was named after this woman, Ayn Rand, and he's very much in that category, that philosophy, and that's why he's saying, let's take the immigration bill and just strip out the citizenship part. So we get all these visa workers coming in dependent upon their employers. And by the way, they can't vote.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, so the Bank of America, a couple of whistleblowers have just come forward and filed a lawsuit against the Bank of America for a series of practices that they allege were being done. William Wilson says that the bank conducted what was called a blitz twice a month, every 2 weeks. Case managers were instructed to deny any applications for the Home Affordable Modification Program, the HAMP program. This is where you basically can refi, and it's backed by the government. Why? Well, those HAMP, you know, refis are not as profitable as the old let's just take your home stuff. There were $500 bonuses for filling foreclosure quotas, according to Simone Gordon, another employee who placed 10 or more accounts into foreclosure. Any employee who placed 10 or more accounts into foreclosure in a given month received a $500 bonus. For fewer than 10, they gave things like gift cards to retail stores like Target or Bed Bath & Beyond as rewards. And they lied to clients about documentation. Gordon's affidavit said it was the bank's policy to sit on financial documents borrowers submitted for 30 days, then label them stale and require the homeowner to reapply. Bert Sheeks, the contract employee, was instructed to find any pretext to justify closing loan modification applications, even in cases where we knew the borrower had, in fact, responded with complete documents. Erica Brown, another whistleblower, was instructed to inform, this is a quote from the lawsuit, was instructed to inform every homeowner who called in that their file was under review, even when she could see no one had looked at the documents in question. She personally says she saw more than 100 incidents in which the banks canceled a loan modification due to non-payment when the file showed that all the payments had been received on time. So, we've got some bad actors in this country. Brian Tracy is on the line with us. He's an author, businessman, success expert, CEO of Brian Tracy International, the website BrianTracy.com. And, Brian, I understand that you think we should not be regulating these banksters and other corporations in America quite as much as we are. How can when you hear this kind of stuff?
Well, you know, you have the law of perverse consequences. Every time they pass a law for political purposes, they create a problem, which requires passing another law, which creates another problem. For example, this whole idea of the this home investment where banks were forced to lend money to non-creditworthy borrowers.
That's actually been totally debunked.
Pardon?
The argument that you're putting forward is the old Alex Jones argument that during the Clinton administration, or during the Carter administration, rather, a law was passed that forced banks to loan money to people who were not creditworthy. And It's simply not true. It's been debunked. I mean, it continues to live on in the Alex Jones and Glenn Beckosphere, but the law that you're talking about was a law that outlawed redlining. What it said was that A bank could no longer say, we will not loan to you if you live in this particular zip code, which is what banks used to do. Now, under the law that was passed during the Carter administration, the banks had to look at the individual homeowner's creditworthiness and make the decisions on a case-by-case basis rather than doing it based on zip codes or on city blocks.
Yeah, but
that's
that
it.
Wasn't what caused it. So the subprime meltdown. The subprime
meltdown. That's it. It was the deregulation done by Phil Graham. It was the deregulation of the banks that led to the subprime meltdown. Prior to 1999, it was illegal for banks to loan money to people when they were heavily regulated. They couldn't loan money to people who couldn't afford to pay it back. When those regulations were removed as a result of Graham Leach Bliley in 1999, you know, Phil Graham pushing this thing through because his wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, and Enron wanted seriously big time to get into the banking business, and this blew up the Glass-Steagall Act that for, you know, ever since 1935 had protected our system. When that was passed, then it became legal for banks to loan anything to anybody, and they did, and liar loans came along. They were not invented by the government. They were authorized by the government by virtue of the regulation going away.
You're right. They were authorized by the government, and the banks are so heavily regulated. They're not allowed to make bad loans. And when the government insisted they make the bad loans,
no, the government never insisted they make bad loans.
Sorely, the government insisted they make bad loans.
Boy, and they didn't.
Can't do it. They said, all right, we'll buy the loans from you. And so banks, instead of lending money and making the arbitrage, started to make loans of any kind, but the government guaranteed to buy them all back. That's why the FHA and FDA and so on are bankrupt. This is why the whole economy collapsed.
But it's because of deregulation, not because
totally
of regulation. A government-created
problem.
But it's because of deregulation, not regulation.
No, the banks are the most heavily regulated organizations in the history
they've
of the
been
world.
It was the deregulation of the banks that allowed them to loan money to uncreditworthy people. It wasn't a regulation that required them to. It was deregulation that let them.
If you don't make these loans, we're going to hurt you very badly.
You cannot.
If you do make them, we will buy them from you, so you just make the profits.
I'll tell you what, Brian.
Okay. And not only that,
I'll tell you what, Brian. If you can come back on this program with one example of one bank, even one, in the entire history of the 21st century, one bank that was punished because they said, this person is not creditworthy, and the government came in and said, okay, we're going to threaten you, and the person actually wasn't creditworthy, come back on this program, and I will publicly apologize to you. In fact, you know, I'm on TV. I will bow down to you. But I'm telling you, you've been listening to Glenn Beck or somebody like that. It is not true.
I've just read about 300 or 400, not only newspaper accounts, but books, articles put out by private sector foundations.
Give me one example.
The Heritage Foundation, the Wall Street Journal.
That doesn't make it true. They all talk in generalities. When you say, give me one example of one bank that got backed down by the government because they didn't want to loan money to somebody because that person was unemployed, you can't find it.
Okay, well, that's a really...
If there was such an example, Brian, that person would be as famous as Reagan's welfare queen. We would all know that person's name.
Banks are the most conservative lenders in the history of the world. They simply don't throw money at subprime lenders. They were forced to do it by the government.
No.
Other than that, they would be punished, and so they did.
No,
it
they
to get them to do it. Agreed to buy the mortgages back.
Brian, again, they did it because they could offload the people who were originating those mortgages. First of all, in most cases, weren't even banks. They were mortgage origination companies like Countrywide, and they could offload that mortgage within minutes. I mean, in many cases, these mortgages were held for minutes. And then they skim their fee off the top, and then they offload it to some other bank, and then that bank offloads it to another bank, and eventually it gets to a bank that turns it into a derivative. They bundle thousands of them together, and they turn it in. You know, they turn millions and millions of dollars worth of mortgages into billions of dollars worth of derivatives.
But you know what reserve banking did when Lehman Brothers collapsed? They were lending 42-1.
Right.
And the bottom of their pyramid was government-guaranteed subprime mortgage loans.
And you realize that when they were regulated before Graham Leach Bliley, they couldn't loan more than 13-1.
Until the pyramid fell down.
But
it was because the government
stopped regulating
these subprime loans.
It was because the government stopped regulating them. The government, we used to, the federal, the banking authorities used to enforce a 13-1 maximum ratio. And right. when Alan Greenspan actually lobbied to pull that thing back, and you know, they did. They pulled it back.
Well,
Bill Seidman, the guy
why don't we just put this aside for
okay.
now?
Give me another example of bad regulations.
You were asking me about my feeling about government regulations interfering with entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
I think we have been, but it's only got a minute left. But
all right. Well,
give me your best.
The bottom line is that the most entrepreneurial countries create the greatest number of jobs and wealth and opportunities for the most people, and the ones who are the least entrepreneurial are the ones that have the highest taxes and the most regulations, and they go in the opposite direction. And we're going in the opposite direction.
I don't know. Somalia has pretty low taxes and very low regulations. But Sweden, with a lot of taxes and a lot of regulations, seems to be doing better than Somalia.
Yes, but if you look at the Swedish tax system, which I've examined very carefully, they leave virtually all private property in private hands. So there's enormous incentives. Also, they allow an enormous amount of deductions that are not allowed in the U.S. Tax laws in the U.S. are actually more onerous for corporations than in Sweden.
Okay. Brian Tracy, you got the last word there, Brian. BrianTracy.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Should we deregulate everybody? I don't think so, but Rand Paul does. Welcome back to our listeners in Portland, Oregon. You might want to check out kboo.fm, kboo.fm, and also Jim Riva. My old friend Jim Riva has his book out. It's called The Geographer. And it's just one of my favorite books. You will love this book. It's a novel, and it's free as an ebook on Amazon's KDP Select program. You can go over to jimriva.com, jimriva.com. And for those of you in the Washington D.C. area, this Saturday at 2:30 in the afternoon, I'll be at the Portrait Gallery, and along with two-time Oscar-winning filmmaker Barbara Kopple, who is going to be showing her movie Running from Crazy, which is about the Hemingway family, and then I'll be moderating Q&A with Barbara after the movie. So show up, be there, or be square if you're in the D.C. area. It should be very interesting. So just a couple things that are going on. So Irby, how do you say it in Bryson City, North Carolina?
Irby.
Irby, how you doing?
Tom, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
I have two issues.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the NSA, what's going on with them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why people have a hard time with them. It seems to me that they've said that no Americans are targeted.
Without a warrant.
Without a warrant, yes, sir.
Right. And if that's the case, I don't have a problem with them either. My concern, and I think the concern that Ed Snowden was talking about, is not so much the NSA as it is the private contractors that they have handed this work out to, who are working in a much less regulated environment and are not government employees, and their first loyalty is to the buck, not to national security. And
yes, sir. I understand that. But what I also have a problem with is with the government giving so many contracts out.
Mm-hmm.
I served with the 82nd Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
We had everything supplied to us without the contractors.
Sure. You had privates doing KP and doing delivery service, and I forget what it's called in the Army.
When we were out in the field, we used to have, the cooks bring us hot meals,
mm-hmm.
Not very often, but
yeah,
it was good. And my second issue is with the Republicans. I just watched the House, and Miss Fox from North Carolina bringing up this thing about abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tom, please shine some light on that.
Well, this is the Republicans. They think that this is what's going to win them elections is making the government bigger and making it more intrusive into women's lives. And while they're preaching small government, and I think that it'll probably get the misogynist vote, and it'll get It's pushing the edges, Ben. But I think that this is also a symptom of what happens when the Supreme Court decides things that should be decided by we the people, specifically Roe v. Wade. But that's a whole other argument. That's an argument against judicial review. But you're right. It's a spectacle right now. What's going on in the House of Representatives? And this 20-week fetal pain bill of going off on this there should be a national conversation about this. But this is not the way the Republicans are conducting it, and it's not happening in a rational fashion, I don't think. Anyhow, thanks for the call. Steve in River Forest, Illinois. Hey, Steve, you wanted to respond to Margaret Thatcher?
Yeah, if there's no such thing as society and it's all just a bunch of individuals, then there's really no such thing as music. It's all just a bunch of individual notes. And there's no such thing as cities. It's really just a bunch of individual buildings. What it's really denying is categories. But the most pernicious thing about the Ayn Rand thought virus is this idea that they always imply that the beginning and ending of all ethics is individual liberty. But a person stranded on a desert island does not have any ethical dilemmas. It requires others.
Right. Right. And also has arguably no liberty. Or, in the Ayn Rand world, absolute liberty. To die. Yeah. Excellent point, Steve. Excellent point. Thank you for calling and making them. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, you wanted to disagree? There's no we in this nation? Really?
I do want to find a little disagreement with your statement of we. When you bring up we, are we really wanting to do this? I think back during the Bush administration, that administration established a real hardcore difference between most people in this country and the trust between the people and the government. That was so severely damaged and continues to be to this day. Mm-hmm. The we is wishful. It's hopeful. And I'm with you on that, but I don't think there exists any real we. There does for some people. Some people.
I think that there is a we, and it's alive and well in communities, in neighborhoods where people are getting together and doing community gardens, in places where people are getting together and doing community activism and political action, in those over 300 communities that have voted and several states that have voted to say we're going to amend the Constitution to say corporations aren't people, money isn't speech. There's, community. There's a lot of we's in this country, Bob. I live in a marina, which is like, everybody there could a big wind and we're all dead. And so people get to know each other and they look out for each other. I think that's the nature of humans is to know and look out for each other.
Well, could I continue with my point, which is to say that in this country that ideal, I share that ideal with you, but I don't think in this country that's what's going on.
Yeah.
I think it's been destroyed.
I don't think it's going on anywhere near as much as it should, respectfully. But but I think it's still here. I think America, I think American community, and thank you for the call, Bob. I appreciate it. I think American community is still alive and well. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour. More of my thoughts on the news and the news of the day, and your thoughts on my thoughts. Well, the Republicans have decided to crack down on rapists. Yes, they're going to do it via the route of pregnant women. You can only get an abortion if you've been raped, if you have called the police. And they have agreed that you've been raped. This is Representative Marsha Blackburn, the Republican from Tennessee. The bill has been amended. It does allow exceptions for rape and incest in the life of the mother, and that was the appropriate step to take. And then Craig Melvin, an anchor with MSNBC, says, but the bill only allows the exception for rape when it's reported. It only allows the exception for incest when it's reported. Is that correct? Blackburn. There is a reporting requirement in the text of the bill, and the hope is that that will help in getting some of these perpetrators out of the population that are committing these crimes against women and against minor females. End of quote. In other words, the House Republicans have decided to go against rapists by banning abortion, unless you reported it as rape, to the police. Remarkable. David in Portland. Hey, David, what's up?
How are you doing? I've just been listening to your callers, and the last fellow was talking about the loss of community, and I like your hopeful message that there are communities, and I believe there are. I think it.
Portland's full of.
Oh yeah, definitely. I love it. I'm an activist over here, and I think that people have to understand. I think there's a lot of disillusionment right now because, you know, everyone's realizing they've been lied to. I mean, from the Dick Morris on Fox predicting Mitt's, you know, crushing victory and everything else, everybody's just kind of disillusioned. And I think it's coming down to the fact that the strategy has been just to divide everybody.
Right.
And we got to all come together and realize that they've been trying to divide us and lie to us. And then they're playing us all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, David. And very well said. And that's where we need to be. You know, speaking back. Thank you very much for the call. That's where we need to be speaking back. It's where we need to be speaking out. I mean, when somebody like Marsha Blackburn comes along and says that they're going to, you know, without debating the merits or demerits of, you know, banning abortion, says that they're going, that the purpose of the anti-abortion bill is to stop rape, is to stop rapists, to weed the rapists out of the community. Then I think you pretty much have to say this.
What you've just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
And, you know, the tip of the hat to Gustav in the chat room. I hope I made your day. All right, back to our phone calls here. If I can get my mouse to work. There we go. Steve in Vancouver. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So, I want to talk about the NSA and phone records and the thought that the records of our phone calls are not our phone records.
That's right.
What I mean by that is about 5-6 years ago in Reno, I gave you a tie-dye shirt.
Oh, great. I remember that.
The red, white, and blue peace sign on tie-dye shirt.
I remember that.
And,
thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, I'm living in the Portland area now.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see. If the government comes to me and says, we want the records of everybody that owns one of your tie-dye shirts, it's up to me to tell them or not tell them who it is,
right,
who they are.
Right.
So
unless they have a subpoena or a warrant.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's my responsibility to say get a warrant.
Yeah.
So that's the way it is with our phone calls. Mm-hmm. Our phone calls, the records of our phone calls are the property of the phone company.
That's right.
And so we can get all upset as we want about the government knowing who we called. It's up to the phone company to determine whether or not they want the government to get a warrant.
And see, this is a really important point, Steve, because I think that there's a very real possibility that over the next decade, over the next few years, if this conversation continues and more people like Ed Snowden start coming out, not just in the NSA, but right across the board. I mean, he's the fourth major NSA whistleblower, but there are also whistleblowers, you know, the AT&T whistleblower and so forth, that at some point, particularly if we can get money out of politics, at some point Congress might sit down and say, you know, the list of my phone calls, or let's say your phone calls, Steve, the list of your phone calls is not actually, if AT&T is your phone company, it's not actually AT&T's property. It's your property. And if they want to sell that list to somebody, which they do, If they want to offer that list to another company, you know, if they want to aggregate that list along with other data, the way, I mean, this is Google's business model, is aggregating data and then selling it. If they want to do that, they have to pay you, or they have to at the very least get your permission. Now, right now, when you sign the contract to get your phone, you are giving them that permission. You are giving them ownership of all of your content and all of your data and all of your... But at some point, somebody's going to start standing up and saying, "No, wait a minute. This should not be the phone company's property." And of course, it's really hard to do that right now in this era of monopoly phone companies. If the government were simply to pass a law in the United States that said, like they do in France or like they do in Germany or like they do in most European countries, that anybody can compete in the telecommunications business. And whoever owns the actual copper or the towers, the cell towers, they cannot lock out others. They have to rent that space at whatever it costs them to have it available, plus a small and reasonable profit. They have to rent that space to anybody else who wants to compete with them. So that over those copper wires or over those cell phone towers, you can now have 100 companies competing with each other. And then you will have companies coming forward who say, you know, AT&T charges you $40 a month and they own your data. We're going to charge you $50 a month, but you own your data. And we're not going to be able to sell your data. We're not going to keep any records of your data. We're going to charge you a little extra for that because we won't be able to make a profit with your data. And I think that would, you know, there would be a competitive advantage, that you'd have an actual marketplace. But because we have these telephone monopolies that have been sanctioned by government, because since 82, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, and nobody has since, it ain't happening. And it should be happening. And it should be happening at the state level and nationwide. Am I making sense, Steve?
That makes perfect sense to me. I'm not saying we shouldn't be outraged by this happening, but we really don't have a choice in it right now.
Yeah, and that is something that we should be outraged about. We should do something about it. Steve, thank you for the call. Paul, and thanks for the T-shirt. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, what's up, Tom? I just wanted to remind everybody about that caller you had earlier blaming the mortgage crisis on the government. It was the banks that did it.
Right.
The FBI went to the Bush administration early on in their administration and told them that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud being committed right now, and it has a serious potential to hurt our economy. The Bush administration thanked them and then promptly reassigned all those people to terrorists.
That's right. I had forgotten about that, but you're absolutely right. The Bush administration was warned, and it was by the FBI. You are absolutely right. Paul, thanks a lot for that. Bob in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Bob, you Moral Monday in North Carolina?
That's correct. I was there yesterday with my wife and a number of friends.
Tell everybody about it.
Well, I'll do the best I can. As you know, the last 7 weeks, this has been a call from the Reverend William Barber of the NAACP. He's the president of the NAACP. In response to the, I'll be charitable, horrific choices, legislative choices that the North Carolina General Assembly has been doing. Mm. Basically, it's been a cut blows to all the things we hold dear, from education to the environment to voting rights to workers' rights to health care. And basically, what he has organized is on every Monday for the last 7 weeks now is basically using the right in the state constitution to educate our legislators. That means people go in law-abidingly in a nonviolent fashion into the state house and basically state their claim and state what they want to have happen. It has been unfortunate that the Speaker of the House ordered that anybody in there after a certain amount of time to be arrested, but it has not deterred almost 500 people for the last almost 7 weeks to be arrested, and it just keeps building. So it really is a great coalition of the faith community. It is also a great coalition of other groups as well, and people of all ages, all sex, all races. It's truly a community standing up to what has been, quite frankly, trying to roll back the clock on the gains from the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah, or maybe arguably 150 years.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, are these going? Yeah, I mean, they would love to disenfranchise all the African Americans in the state, for example. Moving forward, are the Moral Monday programs going to continue every single Monday? There's no end point?
Yes.
Absolutely. Oh, I should say right now the General Assembly will stop after, I think, July 3rd.
Right.
But next Monday is going to be the Mega Monday, so we're trying to bring in everybody. So anyone within your earshot, you know, they are welcome. Especially people, citizens here of this of the great state of North Carolina.
Okay.
But you know,
I'm going to ask Sean Taylor, our executive producer, to see if we can line up somebody from the ACLU or the NAACP. It's the NAACP in North Carolina who's doing this, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, okay. We got to get somebody on the program to talk about it. Bob, thanks for the information. Thanks for sharing this with our listeners and our viewers. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or I should say back on. We had Reverend Barber on two months ago, talking about this. Yeah, we'll get him back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Liz in North Aurora, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. I'm so annoyed with this privacy issue, because if you have such a big problem with it, then don't use a phone, don't use a cell phone, don't use a credit card, don't use the internet, don't do all this stuff. I mean, it's not a big deal. And also, back in the olden days, we didn't have such terrorism and mass shootings because there was a technology so much better now, and it's a privilege. So get over it.
So let me get this straight. We used to not have terrorism because we didn't have the technology. And if you don't
with technology, you're going to get terrorism, you're going to get privacy concerns and all kinds of...
I would say that, you know, we didn't have the terrorism because we didn't used to be bombing Muslim countries.
Well, maybe, but that's not what we're talking about. I mean, we're talking about privacy and everything.
Well, okay, so you're saying that I should just get over it, and if I'm concerned about somebody listening to my phone calls or reading my email, just don't use email and don't use the phone. That, in the modern day, does not seem like a viable option. Why can't we have, I mean, at the time of the founding of this country, we had the post office. Ben Franklin had created the post office before the United States was created. And the Fourth Amendment says that your personal papers, letters, I think the word letters is in the Fourth Amendment, but and it certainly has, you know, I mean, postal regulations have been there since the beginning, so it's always, there has always been a sense, houses, papers, and effects, it doesn't say letters, but there's always been this sense that if you send something through the mail, that's protected. If somebody opens it, they've broken a federal law, they have violated your privacy. Why should that not extend to other forms of basically mail?
Well, because with technology, you're going to lose privacy, and you're going to lose.
Why do you have to?
Just because it's new.
But the mail was new at one point in time,
when mail first started, the problem wasn't a law saying you can't open Joe's mail if you're not Joe.
There was passed, I believe, during the George Washington administration, legislation that said that you can't open people's mail. It's been on the books for a long, long time. I mean, centuries. The mail has been sacrosanct. The post office is actually mentioned in the Constitution. I know that. It's in Article 1, Section 8, and I think it's 7 or 8 sentences in that, you know, the Congress can appropriate money to pay for postal roads and post offices. And, you know, for a long, long time, we have, I mean, from the founding of our country, we've said that your essential person, your personal, you know, your papers, your person, your resident, that you should have the right to privacy. And
also way fewer people and less laws and less concerns with privacy. This is all a big conundrum.
You can't, you know, try filling out a student loan application or filing for unemployment without using the internet or using your telephone or making a doctor's appointment. I mean, how could a person not use these things today?
Oh, follow it up. I mean, if you're going to borrow money, you're going to have to be out in public and out in communities and talking to people.
So we should all just all take all the curtains off our windows.
Come on.
No, I'm serious. The reason why we have curtains in our windows, the reason why we put letters inside envelopes, is the same reason why we have some reasonable expectation of privacy with regard to our email and our telephone conversations, that we want to choose what we're going to disclose to the public rather than having somebody else choose it for us.
No one's trying to look in your window if you have a curtain. No one's going to try to outlaw curtains or the,
No, what I'm saying is your logic suggests that if you live in an apartment building and the person who owns the apartment building, or if you rent a house and the person who owns the house decides that your windows will not have curtains, then, hey, tough luck. Do you own the house you're in, Liz?
That's a big reach.
No. Do you own the place that you live?
Yeah.
Do you have a mortgage?
Yes.
Okay, so your bank actually owns your home. So the, your bank could come to you and say...
They're not going to come to my house and say, we're going to look at you.
Yeah.
They're not going to say it, no.
But that's the next logical step. I mean, where do we say enough already, we have a right to privacy?
Well, when they say that, when they do that, we can...
Okay, so for you, the point at which when a private corporation says, I'm going to invade your privacy, for you, the point where you say, no, you're not, is your windows.
You just don't use their services. I mean, it's not that big a deal.
So then I should say to you, Liz, don't have a mortgage, and then you can't complain about the fact that the bank can demand that you not have curtains.
Right, because save money and buy a house. And don't use a mortgage.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
No, it's not. What you're suggesting is something that's not consistent with modern society. I mean, I don't understand why you would.
Well, I know it's not. I mean, it's so outrageous that you shouldn't have such a big deal. Shouldn't have such a problem with privacy.
Why not? Why shouldn't privacy be a big deal?
Because I don't know.
Okay. All right. Liz, thank you for the call. I think we kind of worked our way through that one. Lisa in Indianapolis, Indiana. Lisa, we have just a minute to the end of the hour.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the Bank of America, and the first thing I wanted to say is so many people think that people bought houses they couldn't afford, and that's not what happened to a lot of people. For example, my husband and I were both teachers. He was a college professor. I taught. We had plenty of money. He got sick. And it wasn't that we had overextended not knowing. It was that we couldn't sell our house.
Right.
And then when we tried to work with the bank, all those things that you were talking about happened to us, where they lost our documents.
Right.
We called every few weeks. We lost, you know, nothing was ever the right way.
Yeah.
And we fought with them for 5 years before we finally had to short sale our house.
Oh, amazing. I'm so sad. I'm so sorry to hear that. Lisa, thanks for sharing the story. Excellent point.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, surprise, surprise. Welcome back, by the way. Surprise, surprise. Just when we thought the big banks couldn't hit a new low, they pulled it off. I mentioned this briefly in the last hour, but it certainly bears revisiting. Here's the details now. Six former employees of the Bank of America have come forward alleging that that big bank intentionally denied eligible homeowners mortgage loan modifications and then lied to those homeowners about the status of their mortgage payments and their documents. Bank of America allegedly used these dirty tactics to lead homeowners into foreclosures and in-house loan modifications, both of which helped reap massive profits for the Bank of America. The employees who have come forward have also said that the big bank rewarded customer service representatives, the frontline people, the people you call on the phone, the people you talk to, the customer service representatives with hefty cash bonuses and gift cards to popular stores when they foreclosed on people's homes. According to a lawsuit filed in federal court, a Bank of America employee who placed 10 or more mortgage accounts into foreclosure a month could get up to a $500 bonus. The lawsuit also alleges that the bank punished representatives who did not hit foreclosure target numbers or who objected to the bank's tactics. In some cases, those employees who didn't foreclose on enough people were fired.
You didn't foreclose enough homes. You are out of here. You've lost your job.
Seriously. This latest jaw-dropper out of Bank of America comes just days after it was revealed that the bank was also using deceptive mailers and sales pitches. Remember those? I mean, this is like, what, a week or so ago? That the federal government was saying, hey, you're not supposed to be doing this. They were using these sales pitches to sell consumers on mortgage refi plans that would actually add tens of thousands of dollars to the cost of a loan and extend the period of the loan for, in some cases, decades. But despite these latest revelations about foreclosure targets, about the lies and the dirty tactics, I don't think anybody at Bank of America is worried about going to jail. Why? Because our elected lawmakers in Washington, D.C., particularly Republican lawmakers, are scared straight by the idea of going after the big banks and going after corporate America. Yet these same lawmakers are just fine going after the big bad government, especially when it comes to things like the IRS controversy. So let's look at the parallels between the IRS controversy and the latest news coming out of the Bank of America. With the IRS controversy, the IRS agents deliberately went after and applied a higher scrutiny to potentially political organizations, liberal and conservative, applying for 501c3 tax-exempt status. At the Bank of America, employees allegedly intentionally denied eligible homeowners loan modifications and pushed them into foreclosure to get a bonus. With the IRS scandal, one IRS official took the fifth when testifying before Congress, but is the subject of both a criminal and an internal investigation. At the Bank of America, it's alleged the customer service representatives were rewarded for lying to homeowners about the status of their mortgage payments and documents. Despite the obvious similarities between these two scenarios, only one is being investigated loudly and publicly by Congress, and that's the IRS controversy. So why is Congress willing to go to the ends of the earth to get to the bottom of the IRS controversy, but refusing to lift a finger when it comes to investigating America's big banks? Could it be the employees of the IRS do not make multi-million-dollar campaign contributions to members of Congress? Could it be that employees of the IRS don't spend hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying? Could it be that employees of the IRS never committed a crime? And even the media, which is supposed to be an impartial and unbiased source of news and information, is afraid to go after big banks when they commit crimes. But the media has been very willing to drag on ad nauseum about this manufactured witch hunt like the IRS controversy.
Breaking news out of Washington, a bombshell admission by the IRS. The tax agency is officially apologizing for subjecting conservative groups to additional scrutiny during the 2012 election.
Jay Sekulow is an attorney and chief counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice. He represented 27 of the groups targeted by the agency. They admit they did it because you forced them to admit they did it.
Well, we applied for our tax status in 2010. We waited 18 months. They sent these letters that wanting a lot of information they weren't allowed to ask us.
Send us your Facebook pages, your Twitter pages. And I said, does that include personal pages? And they said everything.
Right. Meanwhile, this has been the extent of the media's coverage of the egregious actions of the big banks. Yep. America's collective attitude toward the big banks and corporate America needs to change. Bank of America should not get just a slap on the wrist while our elected officials in Washington waste their time and our tax dollars harassing unionized government employees at the IRS who increasingly it's looking. Elijah Cummings finally released the transcripts today that Daryl Issa didn't want to release. Turns out the IRS person who decided to look into the Tea Party was a registered Republican who is self-described as a conservative who said that there was no word from Washington to do this. They just did it. There's no there for Daryl Issa and the IRS. But with the banks, I mean, look at the calls we were just getting in the last hour. People saying, this happened to me. This happened to me. Yep, I submitted the paperwork. They told me they'd lost it. I sent it in again. They said, oh, we can't find it. I sent it in again. They said, oh, yeah, somebody's looking it over. We'll get back with you. Never got back with me. Then they foreclosed. Congress and the Department of Justice should hold the big banks accountable for their actions, because America cannot afford another big bank-caused economic and financial disaster. I mean, it's really that simple. The banksters are up to their old tricks. They are doing the exact same stuff they were doing before. More people are going to suffer. More people are going to get sucked in by this stuff. These banks and their stockholders and their CEOs, they're going to make, you know, it's going to be a whole nother bubble. Oh, the housing market's back. Oh, isn't that wonderful? No, it's a bubble. The stock market, it's higher than it's ever been. Well, yeah, might have something to do with the rich getting richer. I mean, the stock market is where the rich put their money. Might have something to do with our tax laws. It might have something to do with the way that the Fed is offering, you know, money at virtually zero interest rate to our banksters. And then they're loaning it out to big corporations at 1 and 1.5%, 2%. Now, by the way, those same banks would be glad to loan it to you at 29% on your credit card. I mean, this system is not only rigged. Elizabeth Warren pointed that out. Remember when Elizabeth Warren came along and she said, when she was running for the United States Senate, and she said, you know, people say the system is rigged. It is. Well, actually, here's Elizabeth in her own words.
People feel like the system is rigged against them. And here's the painful part. They're right. The system is rigged. Look around. Oil companies guzzle down billions in profits. Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Does anyone here have a problem with that?
Yes, Jamie Dimon, we just want to bow down to you in Congress. That's all, you know. Fly in your private jet and we will be at your feet. Lloyd Blankfein, you are one of the gods. Well, wasn't it Jamie Dimon? No, it was Lloyd Blankfein who said we're doing God's work back in the day. Right. Doing God's work. Ripping off the working people. Helping the billionaires hide their money offshore. Creating derivatives and you know, creating basically a disaster for everybody. We need some fundamental reform in this country. And unfortunately, it's not going to come when you've got both an administration and a Congress that are afraid to even talk about taking on the banksters, with the exception of a few brave souls like Elizabeth Warren and Peter DeFazio. We got to get money out of politics.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It always seems to come back to that. You know, it's like the original sin. And it wasn't even brought to us by Congress. It was brought to us by the Supreme Court. MoveToAmend.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, I just want to comment specifically about the banks. Let's remember that the six largest banks are controlling over 50% of the assets.
And over 60%.
The number one risk is over 50%.
Yeah. No, I said over 60%, actually. It's
60. Yeah. Okay, so it's even larger.
Yeah.
Well, the main thing that you want to get is the large banks are the ones that are having this gigantic derivative exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And since Obama came into office, the amount of nominal derivatives by the largest banks has increased by about 41%, somewhere in the neighborhood of close to $300 trillion.
Right.
And I've got a real simple solution, okay? It costs absolutely no money. When you walk into a bank, there's a symbol, and it says FDIC coverage. Right next to it, every bank has to put every quarter the amount of derivative exposure that they have.
Right.
The clients, we're not forcing them to. We're not saying you can't do it. All we're saying is the clients are now going to decide what to do with their money. And if you walk into a bank and I say, hey, Bank of America, you're sitting on $260 billion worth of derivatives, I might not want to keep my money there. I'm going to go to the local guy down the street.
Right.
And until people make a decision, and this is the problem, we're talking about this issue, but how many people are serious enough to go, this is bad, I'm going to go down to my bank today and close out Bank of America. I'm going to close yeah. out my Wells Fargo. I'm going to close out my Citigroup. And the problem is they just get stuck in this feedback loop where they just keep going, well, they get upset, but they never do anything.
Right.
So we really have to have a big push for people, take your money out of these large banks because right. they are endangering the
economy. And put it into local community banks or into credit
Absolutely.
Unions.
Absolutely. They're not doing derivatives, yeah. okay? And if
I did that. We had a 5 years or four, maybe it was more like 3-4 years ago, and when I was on the air in Portland and or doing a local morning show, we were pushing really hard for people to get out of the big banks. And I actually opened an account very publicly with one of the local public credit unions, Unitas is the credit union, and talked about it on the air and encouraged other people to do the same thing. And this is something that needs to be done. It's just to protect yourself. I mean, just to protect yourself, because when these big banks go down, and they will, they are fully expecting that we are going to bail them out just like we did last time. And the odds are we will. But there's going to be so much political pressure not to this time around that it's possible they won't get bailed out. And if they don't get bailed out, then you are going to see 1929 all over again, or really 1932, February, March, and April of 1932. When about 90% of all the banks in the United States failed. I mean, just failed. And people lost everything. And people would show up at the bank and say, I deposited $20,000 with you. The bank would say, no, it's gone. Sorry. And, we could have that kind of a scenario here in the United States. And the FDIC, do they have the resources to back it up? Well, yeah, maybe up to the I think it's $250,000, the $250,000. But maybe not. And even if they do, is that event going to cause such a disaster or so much inflation that money is going to become worth less? And I mean, it's just, or could it be that it'll take you 2 years to get that money? Or how are you going to have to deal with these big banks to demonstrate that you actually have a claim against them? I mean, look at the hassle that people have right now with mortgages. So there's a lot of good reasons, Jason, to get out of the banks. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Andy in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on Minnesota's Progressive Talk, KTNF. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've got to throw another Bank of America story at you.
Okay.
This start of this one is just so sad that my wife and I, the bank actually basically charged us twice 1 month for our mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
My wife had a direct, paid directly out of her checking account, and they took a payment and then they took it again.
Right.
Which knocked her checking account, obviously, way overdrawn, and she got lots and lots of overdraft fees from our other bank, Wells Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
And it knocked us way behind.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us 3 or 4 months to finally get caught up to where we're supposed to be at our mortgage payments. And there came a day when we got a letter from them saying, you're still 2 months behind. What are you talking about? Well, all these fees from when you fell behind. And I was like, oh, you mean from when you took two payments and wouldn't give one back? Oh, that was the other thing. They would not give the other payment back. They actually just applied it to the principal.
Really?
And would not include it as like another month's pay, month's rent. So they didn't say, okay, well, you're 1 month ahead on payments. They said, oh, no, we just took that and put it to your principal. Can we have it back? Well, no. That couldn't have been legal, but what do you do?
That's bizarre.
And that's, 4 years down the road now, we have since had a short sale, and, the house is long gone.
Andy, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, it is what it is, and it's not getting any better for people. I'm so glad you're out there making this known, because there's endless stories of this. It's so common.
Oh yeah.
And something's got to be done.
Yeah, and something should be done by our government. We need to re-regulate our banks. We need to break up the big banks. We need too big to jail and too big to fail are both wrong and not just morally and functionally, but business wise, it's not good for democracy. It's not good for the banks. Andy, thank you for the call and sharing your story with us. Paul in Rifle, Colorado. Paul, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Tom?
Yes, sir. You are a retired phone company operator?
Not an operator. I was a switchman for a subsidiary of
subsidiary of AT&T in the mid-60s and early 70s. And wiretapping was rampant, both legal and illegal, Tom. And and the reason I'm kind of blowing the whistle is I want other retired switchmen to come forward because of the whistleblowers that are coming forward are getting crucified.
Yeah.
And the best defense, I think, is to speak for others to come forward.
To speak the truth. Well, that, you know, those abuses of the 60s and 70s, Paul, are what led to the Church Commission hearings in 72 and led to a lot of those abuses being dialed back through the late 70s and the 80s. And then, you know, by the 90s, you had, well, here we are again. I mean, then after 9/11, everything went to Bushland. Paul, thank you for the call, and thanks for...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And thanks for having the courage to step up and speak out and tell what's going on. We'll be right back. And the very, very quadragesimally ugly, brought to you by Edison Factor, food for your brain at edisonfactor.com. The good, PETA. Earlier this month, the animal rights organization unveiled a new campaign to draw attention to the abuses of the fur industry that stars four Miss USA contest winners. In the new series of ads, an example of which you can see on their website, the four beauty queens pose nude behind a banner of text reading, "Feel beautiful in your skin and let animals keep theirs." Look, some people criticize PETA for using sex to sell activism, but if showing naked women is the only way to raise awareness about the horrible treatment animals are subject to in order to create our clothing, then it might just be worth it. Who knows? This campaign might just turn animal rights into the new attractive issue. The bad. Representative Jeff Duncan. Last week, the South Carolina congressman endorsed birtherism and urged Congress to revisit the issue of President Obama's validity during an appearance on right-wing talk show host Rick Wiles' radio program. Take a listen.
And while you guys are rounding up and deporting the illegal immigrants, any chance the House may actually pursue Barack Obama's phony identification papers?
Well, you know,
that's the original scandal.
There you go. I'm all with you. So let's go back and revisit some of these things, because Americans have questions about not only the IRS scandal, but also about the president's validity.
Sorry, Congressman, the only scandal here is you and the fringe party's never-ending obsession with the president's birth certificate. It's racist, and at this point, 6 months into the president's second term, is plain pathetic. And the very, very ugly John Derbyshire. The conservative columnist was fired from the National Review last year after writing an offensive and poorly executed, supposedly ironic article in which he urged his son to beware of African Americans. His new column for Taki magazine won't do anything to help his reputation, however. In that piece, titled "The Sexual Harassment Panic," Derbyshire questions the validity of the military's sexual crisis because, quote, "Women who join the military are outliers in their sex. They're eccentric and prone to behave eccentrically. As a designated victim group, they are especially susceptible to the associated pathologies, e.g. victim hoaxes for attention, spite, or cash reward." Wow. You know, the men who join the military are also a minority of men. That is incredibly ugly. I mean, it's not even logical, and it's ugly. Anyhow... What a day. I mean, what a day. The by the way, there's this big oil spill that has happened up in Alberta. Now the you know, they're like this, it turns out it's the tar sands oil. And they don't know what to do with it. There's oh no. I just caught this headline, raw story. Republican mentions suffering of Jesus amid anti-abortion speech on House floor. It was a man, of course. The Turks, this is fascinating. You know, they're having these protests going on in Turkey right now. And the government is
clamping down, and they're saying, no, you can't stand in the square, in the public square in Ankara, I believe it is Ankara. And so the Turks are saying, okay, we will stand here silently. We will not assemble. We will not talk. They're actually standing in rows and just standing. This is the most powerful form of protest. This is why, you know, nonviolent protest works. This is what happened in Egypt. When the people stood up and they went into Tahrir Square and Mubarak fired at them, and they said, okay, we're going to still stand here. And he killed a couple hundred people. But they didn't shoot back. And the moral outrage of that drove him. His own government crumbled around him. His own generals abandoned him. They said, no, we are no longer going to, you know, have you order us to shoot at nonviolent civilians. This is what Nelson Mandela demonstrated. This is what Martin Luther King demonstrated. And, you know, they're trying it in Turkey. We'll see how it plays out. But it's very different than what's going on in Syria right now, which is why I'm so wary of our getting involved in Syria. In Syria, you've got all these different factions who are going against each other as well as against the government. And then you also have a fair amount of the population that actually still supports the government because they're from that sect, the Alawites, or because they're from some of the minority groups who have been protected historically by Assad. So, a mess. And Putin is saying, don't get into this mess. I think that's good advice, frankly. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Hey, Tom. It's nice to hear you. What a nut house we live in. In any event, I have two things. Mm-hmm. One thing is that, as far as I could tell, there's nothing really serious stopping all the phone companies and the telecoms to form a little consortium and get together and release information for clearances, for discrediting individuals for a fee. Mm-hmm. So they could be for profit, but individuals like, supposing you didn't like Bloomberg and you were running for mayor, so you found everything he did in the last 30 years that might be questionable, and then you doctored a document and you presented it.
Right.
I mean, the thing is that what's made this all possible is the huge cheapness of storage versus digital and voice can be stored forever.
Yeah.
They have 100 years capacity at the NSA, and there's no reason to believe that the phone companies are far behind. They might be. We don't know. So
Well, and if you want to see that in action, Michael, watch the movie Client Number 9. I'm sure it's on available on demand and, you know, a whole lot of different venues. And it's the story of Elliot Spitzer. And what happened was, I mean, as Elliot Spitzer is the first to tell you, in fact, he is in the movie, and he's very contrite in the movie. And he says, yep, that he was buying the services of this particular hooker and others. And, you know, it was wrong, quack, quack, quack. I mean, he goes through that whole thing. But what happened was, as the attorney general for the state of New York, he took on a bankster, a billionaire bankster. And that bankster hired a Republican consultant, a guy by the name of Roger Stone, who is notorious for just taking people down. And Stone hired some private detectives, and they were able to use, some of these technologies to find out that Spitzer had been patronizing prostitutes. And then they tipped off the FBI to the fact that this one. You know, hey, go back and look at this bank transaction. Look at that. In other words, they illegally gave the FBI information that led them to discover what Spitzer was up to. In fact, caused it so that they couldn't ignore what Spitzer was up to, which then forced their hand in busting him, which then, of course, led to his resignation as governor. And frankly, he was on his way to become president of the United States. He would have been the next FDR. And there's no doubt in my mind he would have been the next FDR. But he got taken down by this same thing. It was, you know, the information was there, the trail was there, they could find it, and
the others,
that movie's an incredible cautionary tale.
The other serious point is that economics, contrary to propaganda, is largely based on trust. Yes, you have contracts. Yes, you have legal. But if nobody trusts anybody, we can't trust anything that comes out of the government anymore, in particular, because if something is classified and they lie, they go to jail.
Right.
And the third point, is the money that we're spending on terrorism, admittedly a threat, we could be spending on autonomous vehicles. We could be spending it on electric cars. It's billions upon billions of dollars we're wasting.
Yep.
Talk about waste of money.
Well, and beyond that, if we used it to make ourselves independent of Middle Eastern oil, the terrorists would stop caring about us if we stopped caring about their oil.
Right.
I mean, it really comes down to that. I mean, you know, it's this belief that Americans have that God accidentally put our oil under their sand. And therefore, it's our right to go get it and support any tin pot dictator that we want, or take them out, or whatever, you know, whatever we want, and kill as many people in the process as doing it. And, you know, they tend to take offense at that. They don't like it. So, Michael, thank you for the call. Well, excellent point. Well made. Charles in Indian Head, North Carolina, you wanted to disagree about the Alberta spill?
Yes, it is. Actually, I got the information from Brad Blog.
Right.
And there are two things for that. First of all, it's actually the water that they're using to pump out.
Oh, there are two different spills. There are two different spills. One of them is the brine water, which went into the lake that the Denny are using. And then also there was an oil spill.
All right. Well, if they're both together, like you said, the only information I have came from Friedman on that part. The other thing is have you heard about the water battle that's going on between Texas and New Mexico?
Only in general.
Well, basically what's going on is the fracking industry in Texas and in New Mexico are fighting for this, for the water rights to suck up all the groundwater from there. And one of the areas for this is one of the fracking companies is sucking all the water out from the groundwater that's being used by Mesa, New Mexico, and the town is about to be shut down because they don't have any water.
Wow, just for fracking. That's amazing. Charles, thanks for the info on that. I'll have to check out bradblog.com and see what they've got. I know Brad and Desi are doing a great job in covering green topics. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can drop into our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com. And you can create your own blogs and you can participate in our message boards. It's all free. Check out our new app. It's free, too. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And Paul in Oregon, Wisconsin. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Well, I'm wondering with this, you know, national security program, eavesdropping on everybody and everything. But, you know, back in the 50s, if you signed, say, spoke out or especially signed a petition, you could get on, you know, HUACs or...
Right.
Know,
you'd have Gene McCarthy coming after
FBI's
you.
List.
Yeah.
And that could, as I recall, even include civil rights petitions. So I'm just wondering why nobody seems to remember that.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Arnold Toynbee pointed out that when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable. The people who remember the abuses of Eugene McCarthy in the 1950s are dying out. I mean, you know, in order to remember McCarthy, you would have to be, you know, well into your 60s, maybe your 70s. And those are not the voices that you're hearing on TV. They're not the people that you're hearing on the radio, seen on television. And, you know, it's just like, you know, we're doomed to repeat our mistakes. And I see Ted Cruz as the next Joe McCarthy. I think he's looking at Joe McCarthy as his role model. I mean, you've got Ann Coulter wrote a book about how wonderful Joe McCarthy was, idealizing him, lionizing him, making him into a hero. And I think Ted Cruz read the book and said, I can do that. And, you know, I predict that coming. So we'll see. I hope I'm wrong. But, Paul, you're absolutely right. Thanks for that. Hey, a quick question, Paul. Do you guys pronounce it, since it's in Wisconsin, do you pronounce the city Oregon the way that they pronounce the state out in the West, or do you pronounce it Oregon?
Oh, it's Oregon. We drew the 80.
Oregon. Okay. Interesting.
I lived in Oregon before, so it's confusing to me.
So you live in the state of Oregon, but in the city of Wisconsin and Oregon, Wisconsin, you pronounce it Oregon. Interesting. Okay. Thanks a lot. Pardon my idle curiosity, but when I first moved to Oregon, I was saying Oregon, and boy, did the Oregonians jump down my throat. And I learned really fast how to pronounce Oregon. Everett, listening on WWRL in New York City, but you're calling from Springfield Gardens. What's up, Everett?
Hey, Tom. First time caller, long time listener.
Thank you.
I was listening up to your callers about Bank of America. Bank of America hold my mortgage. They're as crooked as a barrel of fish hooks, let me tell you.
Crooked as a barrel of fish hooks. I love it.
I had an experience with them that I had to raise so much hell before they reversed it.
Mm-hmm.
My bank, I pay my mortgage through my bank. You know, every month I just go into my account, and I know the amount to pay, and I plug it in there and just send the payment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my escrow party was raised by about $5, so it increased my mortgage by five. I don't know if they notified me or not, but anyway, I send the payment out. They kept the payment. They cashed my check and then waited until after the date, the that little time they give you to pay, after the 15th.
Right.
And sent me back a check and say they don't accept partial payment for $5 less, and then tack on $110.87 late fee.
Wow.
I told them I'll call the president if I have to. And the woman was nasty, too. And I asked to speak to a supervisor. And, you know, after a while, you know, going back and forth for days, then they reversed it.
Yeah.
They said, Mr. Noll, you know, you haven't been late. You've never been late. And, but you know, it was nasty. And their late fees are just crazy. $110.
Yeah.
If you're late, one day late, $110.
Yeah. Well, it's one of their major profit sources. It's why the banks showed a profit of $40 billion for the first 3 months of this year. Can you imagine? $40 million in surplus leftover money at the end of 3 months. That's what the U.S. banks showed in the first 3 months of this year. It's insane. And they made that, and 110 of it came out of your pocket, Everett. Or at least they tried.
They had enough time to send that payment back to me if they wanted to, or call me on the phone.
I can't say this was very intentional because I don't know. But this is the kind of story that these whistleblowers are saying. That your story is the kind is what these whistleblowers who are participating in this lawsuit against the Bank of America are saying is the kind of standard practice that they were engaging in or is characteristic of it. So, you know, it's sad. Thanks for sharing your story with us, Everett. Appreciate the call. John in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm fine.
Real quick, why do we always have to repeat the past? You know, if you don't remember the past, you're damned to repeat it.
Yeah. I think that it's just like kind of one of those laws of human existence. The one good piece of news is that, you know, every 80 years we repeat the past, but it seems like every 80 years we repeat the past and we get a little better, you know? It's like...
Well, you would hope. But, you know, specifically like Joe McCarthy, now I'm not old enough to have lived that personally.
Right.
But I have seen it in films and documentaries and things of that nature.
Right.
You would think that those kind of things are enough to keep us on the ball, to keep us from making those same mistakes.
No, I think that you had to... I mean, you know, when Joe McCarthy was doing his thing, I was a little kid. I don't have any direct recollection of it either. But it was... I think for my parents who saw it on television every single night, it probably had quite an influence. I wish my dad was still alive. I would love to ask him his thoughts about that because that's one of the few things that we never argued about. Anyhow, John, thank you for the call. I shouldn't say argue. You know, my dad and I had a lot of conversations that were not arguments, just the political ones we'd argue. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news and information from Wall Street and Main Street, all points in between. Plus, the rest of the news, and don't forget, Democracy begins with you. Get out there, show up, participate, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.